You are most welcome to our church in Dublin's St. Stephen's Green. Whether you're here in our building, which is over 150 years old, or attending live on webcam, or listening back in Ireland or in some faraway place, whoever you are, from wherever you come, old or young, rich or poor, you are abundantly and warmly welcome. My name is Paul Murray. I'm a member of the congregation. And every now and again, our minister, Bridget Spain, takes a break, so we volunteer or are volunteered to take the service. And it's my turn today. This is a house of prayer, a haven of reflection, an oasis where we can agree or disagree with each other while still remaining friends. It is a sacred place where every Sunday, as in Unitarian churches around the globe, we light the chalice as a symbol of hope, the sacred, the quest for truth, and the light of reason. Thank you. Thank you, Gavin. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Our reader this morning is Dirren.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me? Good. My reading this morning, some of you may have read it earlier this week in the Irish Times in Joe Humphrey's Unthinkable column, which is something I love to read every week. And this is an extract from what he wrote this week. I would preface it by saying my husband, who was not with us this morning, I sometimes walk into the living room and I see him sitting there, and he's not reading, and he's not watching the television, and he's just looking. And my instinct is to think, is there anything wrong? And I say, what are you doing? He says, I'm thinking. When was the last time you paused for thought? I mean, properly downed tools, turned away from the screen, and surrendered to introspection. Hannah Arendt liked the English phrase, stop and think. Nobody can think unless he stops, she said. The always-on modern citizen is allergic to stopping. Thinking, says Arendt, is a profitless enterprise as far as results are concerned, yet much of what goes on in our lives and in the world can be put down to an absence of consideration. Arendt, who was born on the 14th of October, just last week, 115 years ago, is famous, of course, for her analysis of evil doing. She used the phrase, the banality of evil, to try and explain the actions of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann. But she was also concerned with everyday human activities and believed unthinking to be a factor in general unhappiness and alienation in society. Samantha Rose Hill, who's written a new biography of the German-American philosopher, says that Arendt was pushing against the emphasis on action over thinking in modern-day society, where it is far easier to do than to think. If reading books is an indication of willingness to think, then the data is not encouraging. An EU study a couple of years ago shows that the average time spent reading books in 15 European countries ranges from 2 minutes a day in France, which I found absolutely astonishing, since I think of the French as a very literary people, but there you go. It ranged from 2 minutes a day there to just over 10 minutes in Finland and Estonia. Reading in general has migrated online, and while this might seem to offer a platform for thinking, introspection is next to impossible when there's a constant stream of alerts, comments, notifications, and pop-up ads. Hill says that Arendt described thinking as a two-in-one conversation that I have with myself. It requires solitude and space. But Hill remarks that it's not just a room of one's own, as Virginia Woolf said, that's needed. It's a psychic space, creating space in our imagination to expand our thinking. We need to unplug to do that.
Thank you, Dirren. Now, this is the time for the children's story, and for all you children and all the children around the world. I have to say that stories, this was given to me by my mother and probably by her mother. But of course, as we know, stories change through time and little bits are added and little bits are taken away. So the story that I'm telling today is about a lovely little rabbit called Bobby. but he wasn't a happy bunny, and none of the other rabbits would talk to him. Even the girl rabbits wouldn't giggle or blush when they saw him, like they did with the other boy rabbits, and he was left out of all the rabbity games. Bobby was very lonely, and so he hopped along to the only friend he had, to Scrubber, a wise but lazy and smelly cat who was ignored by all the local animals. Even the dogs avoided Scrubber. "Tell me," said Bobby, as he sat on his hind legs, just that little bit away to avoid the smell of Scrubber, "why will no one play with me? I don't look any different. In fact, I have a nicer tail and can hop with the best of them." "Ask it," said Scrubber. "They don't like the way you do things. They don't like particularly that you don't eat carrots. They think that to be a real rabbit, you have to love carrots." "But I am a real rabbit," said Bobby. "And I hate carrots, they make me sick. I want parity of esteem." "Of course you're a real rabbit," said Scrubber. "You're a dissenting rabbit with your own mind. You're like those rabbits in Stephen's Green. A brave little rabbit who will not be forced to eat carrots. Sometimes it can take courage to be different. And one day the other rabbits will see this." "I think," said Scrubber, "that one day they'll make you chief rabbit." "Then you," said Bobby, "could be head cat if you cleaned up a bit and stopped guzzling fish." "Come, Scrubber, my friend," he said, "let's be brave together and face our rabbity catty worlds." So as Bobby and Scrubber hopped and trotted off through the long grass, Scrubber explained. "You see," he said, "you can be a rabbit who loves carrots, a rabbit who loves them sometimes, or a rabbit who doesn't love them at all. This is what the Animal Rabbit Agreement says. Remember, it was signed by Bertie Rabbit, Tony Rabbit, and Peter Rabbit." "And look," said Scrubber, "look over there." And just a meter away, Bobby saw Flopsy, the prettiest girl rabbit of them all. Flopsy, who for 2 summers had wanted to burrow away with Bobby, even if he was a carrot hater. "Go, say hello," said Scrubber. "Even if you've got to take risks if you want to make friends." And so, late that afternoon, Bobby and Flopsy chased rainbows until the earth moved and the sun went down. Thank you, Gavin. For my reading, a short poem by Austin Clark. It's about isolation. It's about how two communities and two different age groups can live apart from each other, but still be in the same community. And it's something I'll be touching on later. The Planter's Daughter. When night stirred at sea and the fire brought a crowd in, they say that her beauty was music and mouth, and few in the candlelight thought her too proud, for the house of the planter is known by the trees. Men that had seen her drank deep and were silent. The women were speaking wherever she went, as a bell that is rung, or a wonder told shyly. And oh, she was the Sunday in every week. A prayer. Let us be mindful that our community gives us strength. Let us be kind to each other, even when that is most difficult. Help us to be broad in our interests and our concerns. Give us the courage to manage life's disappointments. Help us to remember that it's better to have loved and lost than not to have loved at all. Support us in honestly assessing our strengths, weaknesses, personalities, and abilities. Help us to be tolerant of other cultures and beliefs, as we would hope to be tolerated. And remind us that life is just a journey on the way, as many people express it, to heaven. That we have no abiding city. And what God has given, God can take away. And the axe is at the foot of the tree. Let us be silent for a few moments as we pray or meditate on those things that concern us and on those we love. Josh will then bring this period to a close with some nice music. Lovely, Josh. Thank you. The title for this talk is Who Do You Say That You Are? You'll remember a recent television program with a title that was somewhat similar. And of course, going back to the Gospels, Jesus didn't query himself on who he was, but he asked the disciples, Who do you say that I am? And it was Simon Peter who answered that he was Christ, the Son of the living God. The other disciples had said that some men believed he was John the Baptist, others Elias, Jeremias, or one of the prophets. But from the text, it seems that Jesus didn't then respond to his own question. And as has been speculated, perhaps he didn't know the answer. It is vital that we know ourselves, that we know who we really are, and from what setting we come. The phrase, know thyself, of course, goes back to ancient Egypt and was later carved into the temple of Apollo at Delphi in ancient Greece. It comes up with Socrates, who said, and you may remember that Bill Darlison used to often quote this, that an unexamined life is not worth living. And of course with Plato, and many centuries later with Thomas Hobbes, Alexander Pope, Benjamin Franklin, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Samuel Coleridge. So in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of contexts, the injunction to self-identify has always been with us, as those of us living in Ireland well know. Here we'll just concentrate on the matter of our religious, historical, social community identity, which is a significant background to our personality and character. We can then privately go on to pinpoint what else makes us, what we really feel as distinct from what we are trained to feel, what our ethics, our talents, our lack of them. Are we introverts or extroverts? Our sexual orientation. You'll all have been very pleased to hear that, according to DC Comics, Superman has finally come out and said that he's bisexual. Where are we on the spiritual spectrum in our career? If it's prestigious, is it the right one for us? Is our marriage partnership healthy? Should we stay or should we go? Some weeks ago, walking, as many of us do frequently, and this time it was along the West Pier in Dunleary, my companion, someone for whom I have abundant admiration, suddenly bent down, picked up a snail, and tenderly left it on a leaf away from the path. She was afraid it might be stood on, and perhaps that the hot gravel was too much for the snail. I was bemused and related this incident to a sensitive relative. He said he would, of course, do exactly the same thing, as did another friend, a friend who, while strolling the Dodder, identifying plants, trees, and every living thing, recites reams of Wordsworth. Indeed, this friend isn't too sure whether we should kill snakes or rats. So my moral compass was a little shaken. It made me a frequent snail killer, hesitate, wonder if there was a chink in my moral armour. Had I the feet of clay of someone who believed he was at least averagely compassionate? So, do I really know who I am? Do you? Have we self-knowledge? There's an interesting answer to this in the title of Fintan O'Toole's new book, We Don't Know Ourselves. Although it's a phrase, as we remember it, sometimes used by people who, say, won the lotto, you know, we don't know ourselves. O'Toole, of course, is touching on something bigger. Do we as a nation know ourselves? Do we think we know who we are, as distinct from our assumption that we are what we would like to be? Leaving aside the efforts to make sure that we see ourselves as others see us, and the moral issue around the snail — snails are now much safer in my garden — and of course much bigger ethical issues, it is vital for our mental and spiritual health that we understand and accept who we are, that we obey the injunction, know thyself, and as a corollary, that who we decide we are should generally be accepted by others. Why do we need self-knowledge? Well, we need self-knowledge, according to one website I looked up, schooloflife.com, because it offers us a route to greater happiness and fulfillment, while a lack of self-knowledge leaves us open to accident and mistaken ambitions. Armed with the right sort of self-knowledge, we have a greater chance of avoiding errors in our dealings with others and in the formulation of our life's choices. We can, I believe, get somewhat of a fix on who we are by examining our ethnic, religious, social, and community history. For example, how did we, and of course more particularly those who came before us, act and react to the foundation of this state 100 years ago and in its emerging decades? Indeed, we might look at Protestants to illustrate this point. Deirdre Nuttall has written a wonderful book. It's called Different and the Same, which illuminates the difficulties faced in this state since 1922 by many Protestants, people I as a child and teenager in Dunleary would rarely have met. It was a bit like Austin Clark depicted in the poem just read, The Planter's Daughter. Her house was known by the trees, and old men drank deep and were silent. She was there in the village, but she wasn't there for them, nor they for her. Indeed, somebody told me recently that she knew no Catholics when growing up in rural Ireland. That, of course, would be very rare now. And the reasons for this are obvious. The Ne Temere decree made parents nervous that their children would form attachments with Catholics, marry them, and any grandchildren would be lost to Catholicism. There were worries that farms would pass into Catholic hands. Indeed, sadly, according to this book, many Protestants didn't marry or married their cousins because of this worry. And many Protestants feared losing their culture, a culture which often hearkened to the days of empire, a culture which often grudgingly accepted the state's foundation and was dismayed by our subsequent retreat from the Commonwealth. Tony Farmer, in his book Privileged Lives, A Social History of the Middle Class in Ireland, 1882 to 1989, says the common Church of Ireland attitude to the new free state was to abstain. Many Protestants, as Brian Inglis, the writer, testified, as soon as they found out that the new Irish government could be trusted not to expropriate their land, debase the currency, or make general legislative mayhem, they settle down to ignore the free state's existence. Alex Finlater, who those of us of a certain age will remember his shops, said Irish free state politics was simply not mentioned at Protestant tables. For Archbishop Gregg of Dublin and later Armagh, an Anglican, of course, the severance from Britain was a disaster. For him, the British were the trustees of Christianity in a fallen world. It was a society in which the Protestant committee of the Bull Island Golf Club committed, in the words of Inglis, slow social suicide by excluding families in trade, as the phrase went, Roman Catholics and Jews. Hence, we got the Pirates of Penzance in the church hall, badminton games between different C of I parishes, private viewings of Queen Elizabeth's coronation, the Boys' Brigade, discreet Poppy Day collections. In some senses, and in only in some senses, a parallel society, all fueled, I'd suggest, by an oft-times ungenerous state which sometimes refused to recognize that there lived among us a minority of a different hue. And, of course, a rampant Roman Catholic Church which insisted on the, thank goodness, now deleted special position of the Catholic Church in the Constitution. This minority, as W.B. Yeats said, were no petty people, although I think he was referring more to the upper echelons of the Anglo-Irish, a sector which Nuttall doesn't cover in her book. But Protestants were a niche population, and historically, perhaps, we could include ourselves here, which, broadly speaking, did not belong to the perceived official national narrative. As many Protestants interviewed in Nuttall's research said, they were often made to feel they were not really Irish and were sometimes embarrassed by their ancestry, Cromwellian, planter, or whatever. Indeed, some would search around for nationalist connections, such as links to the United Irishmen, in order to dilute any perceived non-Irishness. Edna Longley, the literary critic, remarked in 1989 that if Catholics were born Irish, Protestants had to work their passage to Irishness, and that if Southern Irish Protestants are now more or less uncomplicatedly Irish, the journeys to get there are anything but uncomplicated. According to an intriguing book called Protestant and Irish, which is edited by Ian Dalton and Ida Milne. But it must be recorded that particularly in rural areas, some Protestants reported they had more in common with their Catholic neighbours who were as financially stretched as they were than they had with the big ascendancy house. In one case, the Protestant had to wait outside their church on Sunday until the gentry arrived and were comfortably in their pew. But there were positive relationships across the religious divide, and they're recalled in the book Untold Stories, Protestants in the Republic of Ireland, 1922 to 2002. One witness referring to how Roman Catholic and C of I adherents treated each other with genuine courtesy, would have been good neighbours to one another, but the overwhelming sense was one of difference. And I haven't forgotten Northern Ireland, where the nationalist Catholic minority suffered so much. In the 1920s, my father's family were forced onto a Dublin train by a loyalist gang. He later studied to be a priest, left before ordination, and fell in love with my mother, a woman who had been brought up from the age of 8 by grandparents, Empire loyalists, Royal Dublin Fusiliers, Castle Catholics, if you will, who stood when God Save the King came on the radio. So I'd suggest that to have self-knowledge, we have first to accept and embrace all aspects of our ancestry, whether we're a hybrid, I suppose, like myself. By the way, I was delighted to hear that I'm 2% Asian, according to the DNA analysis. Or whether our lineage is clearly Huguenot, Palatine, Planter, Gaelic, or whatever. Although these labels can be much diluted over centuries by adoption, fosterage, and intermarriage. And this identity, self-knowledge, touches on how our ancestors, we or our ancestors, behaved. A week ago, Dermot Ferriter, UCD's Professor of Modern Irish History, in a lively conversation on the Dublin, in the Dublin Festival of History, he was talking about his new book on the Civil War, said we have to be ready to embrace and admit the awful things done by both pro- and anti-treaty sides, actions which could be and were often as despicable as those of the Black and Tans. In another context, 1798 and 1641, the rebellions had their atrocities, which were hardly mentioned in my Catholic school syllabus. A neglect, I believe, which did no service to our young ears, our healthy historical inquiry, to the mental maturity of our citizens, or to the forging of a modern nation. In fact, we liberate ourselves by accepting who we are and were, what we are our ancestors did or didn't do, as I believe Germany has done. It's really striking how many young people are taken to Berlin's Holocaust Memorial beside the Brandenburg Gate, how in many museums and in public discourse that country has recognized the evil things that were done. Munich, once the nerve center of Nazi activity, was accused some years ago of amnesia in regard to its past. Although a museum there also shows, and a very good museum, posters from modern far-right parties as a warning to indicate the dangers of such beliefs. Indeed, as an aside, I believe that Germany has more openly accepted its past than has Austria. So a vital part of knowing ourselves to be able to answer the question, who do you say that you are, comes through acknowledging from whence we came, embracing, accepting our family, community, past, which is in essence for us an accident of birth or history. Philip Sands, the historian, in his award-winning book, East West Street, describes Lviv, L-V-I-V, I can't pronounce it, the central European city from which his grandfather came and from which the entire Jewish community had been extinguished. The city has been called a number of names, passing from Austria to Russia, then back to Austria, then briefly to Western Ukraine, then to Poland, then to the Soviet Union, then back to Germany, then back to the Soviet Union, and finally to the Ukraine. Its inhabitants surely will have various identities, all now within Ukraine's jurisdiction. Similarly, massive border changes after two world wars posed many identity challenges, not unlike those which have faced the inhabitants in Northern Ireland. And if this analysis of our social, religious, and political ancestry highlights distressing activities, assumptions, or uncivilized behavior, we are not responsible, as the phrase goes, for the sins of our fathers, or indeed for their good deeds. We are only now responsible for ourselves. And like Bobby the Rabbit, We have to go and face the world. In existential terms, we can make our own meaning, taking account, hopefully, of our true knowledge of our strengths, weaknesses, character, and personality quirks. A very wise friend says that our ancestral religious history is essentially a yardstick by which we can measure our future. It can restrict us or open us up to boundless possibilities. It can impair us. In the words of the kid from New York's Bronx, you can't know where you're going to until you know where you're coming from. Thank you. Thank you, Gavin. Bridget will be back next Sunday to take the service. Her address is An Attitude of Gratitude. Our further notices, there is no offertory, but there's a donation box on the way out. It is possible to make a donation to the church online from our website. And I've been asked to thank everyone who supports the church. Uskill magazine for October, edited by Paul Spain, is available in the porch and online. Also, please take copies of the Enquirer magazine. Wednesday's lunchtime meditation is in the church and available on the web camera between 1:05 and 1:35. Thursday evening at 7:30, via Zoom, a discussion group meet to discuss writings from other traditions. This week, there will be a discussion on some verses from the Tao Te Ching, and we will begin to read the Bhagavad Gita. This is via Zoom, and Tony will send the link to join the group during the week. The book club meets via Zoom on the last Wednesday of the month, 6:45 for 7. And then Sunday the 31st is Membership Sunday, for anybody who has been attending for at least 1 year and would like to formally become a member, and if they would give their names to Bridget, who is sitting in the fifth row there. A blessing. If in being here we have found even a little peace. If we have been helped even a little to reflect, to pray, if we feel we've been among a community which, for all its weaknesses, is striving to be tolerant, particularly of that which it does not understand, to be kind when exasperated or challenged, to be open to new ideas and culture, to embrace that which is spiritual within us, then our time together will not have been in vain as we bid each other farewell until we meet again. Thank you very much.